providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. In these final two segments, we're going to focus back on the energy sector as we are chatting again with Dan Steffens, president of the Energy Prospectus Group. Now, we've been bringing Dan on for maybe close to a year now, probably just under a year. And I've really appreciated, first of all, reading over his letter and the coverage that he gives to the energy sector, as well as diving down into all the companies that he follows, including doing a lot of luncheons with companies down in the southern U.S. Now, Dan, we're going to start off more big picture in the energy sector and then get into some of the companies that you like more in the second segment here. First and foremost, though, one consistent aspect that we have been talking about when it comes to the energy sector is the general tight supply for the global oil market. You've been outlining this to us every time pretty much we've had you on the show, and it ties a lot into OPEC Plus just not having the capacity to, it seems like, really even increase their production. And we also need to consider OPEC Plus still seems to be very much in control of the oil sector, very different than a number of years ago when the U.S. had a bit more control here. Dan, give us an update on this global oil market. How tight is it still?
Well, the answer first is it's tight and it's going to get a lot tighter, especially coming this winter, because especially in Europe, they're going to have to maybe burn a lot more oil to generate electricity because they've been cut off from the natural gas out of Europe. That's really, really a big deal. The only thing in the OECD countries, which OECD is Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, US, Canada, you know, Europe, Japan, Korea, Australia, those guys, which are the primarily the consumers of oil in the world of the OECD countries. So they have drained their inventories on a days of consumption level, and they're now they should be at 30 days of consumption. All these countries run on oil, and that will continue for decades more, and they are down below where they've ever been. They're below 27 days of consumption, and it clearly looks like they're headed to go below 25 days of consumption, which could mean that some refineries around the world would have trouble finding crude oil to make the fuels this world runs on. And if that happens, you're going to start having, you know, shortages of diesel, gasoline, home heating oil, stuff like that. So we really have the potential for a global oil crisis and our energy crisis across the board. And, you know, it's just where we are. But a little history lesson, the COVID-19 pandemic, it caused a glut of oil. It was the biggest global drop in demand for oil-based fuels ever. And it caused a glut of petroleum-based above-ground inventories that occurred and peaked in the second quarter of 2020. But then from mid-2020 to mid-22, that, 8 quarters or 24 months, the amount of oil in above ground inventories declined by an average of 2 million barrels per day. It started slowly, but we got back to pre-pandemic level in the middle of 2021. We got back to where we were on inventories in 2019, but it kept going down. And so then recently, you know, that the United States and a lot of the OECD countries have been forced to drain their strategic petroleum reserves. And we're heading toward taking 180 million barrels out of our strategic petroleum reserve. It's supposed to stop at the end of this month. It's dangerously low now. But if you look at our total petroleum reserves, both commercial and SPR, we're down like 350 million barrels from where it had peaked. So, and way below where we need to be as a, first world country or whatever you want to call it. But OECD inventories has a reverse relationship to the price of oil. So as the inventory drops, the price has to go up. And if it drops far enough, you basically have to start rationing oil and petroleum products by price. You have to keep raising the price to hopefully, lower demand and stimulate more exploration production. That's kind of the goal of the price thing. But anyway, right now, IEA, which is based in Paris, France, they are heavily influenced by all this climate change stuff and the Paris Climate Accord. But they are still forecasting a demand growth in 2023 of 1.7 million barrels per day. And that's come down. It was, you know, prior to Russia going into Ukraine, they were forecasting like over 3 million barrels a day of increased demand next year. So that has been adjusted for the situation in Europe. And I don't see where that 1.1 million barrels a day is going to come from. A big surprise for everybody has been how slowly U.S. oil production has come back. And actually, it has flatlined. We were close to 13 million barrels a day, and we are now having trouble keeping it at 12 million barrels a day. And oil production in the U.S. and in Canada always declines when you get into the winter months. Weather does impact oil field work, especially when you get up in North Dakota and, you know, in the Rockies and stuff, a lot of our oil comes from like the DJ Basin in Colorado. And once you get, you know, several feet of snow on the ground and sub-zero temperatures, it's very difficult to complete wells. So that's kind of where we are. And demand for oil is just grows relentless. Before we started this recording, we were discussing how if you got a 50-year chart of demand for oil, it pretty consistently goes up. And, you know, 1 to 1.5% per year. And there's only been a couple, you know, declines that have lasted for more than a couple quarters. And that was, you know, mid 2008, the financial crisis, and then this COVID situation in 2020. But other than that, it just keeps coming back to the historic trend line. And that's exactly what happened this time.
Well, Dan, just to that point of just how tight the supply is for the oil and gas markets, I don't think a lot of people in their general lives realize how low the reserves are right now, how little we have after releasing strategic reserves in the U.S., not just of oil, but also of nat gas, but also how quickly things could go off the rail. And I'd like to focus on some of the shortages we're seeing in diesel, some of the shortages we're seeing in DEF, and some of the shortages we're seeing in heating oil, because all of these have to be refined and people's lives can be interrupted, and so can trade if we don't do something soon. So could you break that down, that market, please?
Well, one of the reasons that U.S. oil production has not come back up is because the supply chain has impacted well completions. A lot of the upstream companies I talk to, they're unable to secure the tubulars, the pipe. If you go and you drill, you know, a well down a mile, mile and a half, and then sideways for 2 miles, you can't pull that rig off without casing the well. If you pull that out, that hole could collapse. So you have to run casing, steel tubing, all the way to the end of that well to hold it open, and then you'll come back and complete it later. You know, in 2020, we were drilling wells but not completing them. It was going to what they call the DUC inventory, drilled but uncompleted wells. Well, last year and the first part of this year, we completed all the good DUCs. So the DUC inventory has been depleted. There's not a lot of good wells waiting to be completed, and we're having trouble finding tubular. So kind of on a hold, and I expect U.S. production to actually decline during the winter months. It usually does anyway, because weather does impact oil field equipment. So there's nothing anywhere in the world that I see other than we just, you know, come to peace terms with Iran or peace terms with Venezuela overnight. And even if that happened, it would take months before that oil would actually hit the physical market. So in the near term, it's going to stay extremely tight. And, you know, our government's, you know, war on fossil fuels is definitely not helping the situation.
So, Dan, I've been hearing that the market is tight and price is even dictating that it is tight, right? Oil is back up to around $90 a barrel. That's crude. It is off of its highs of earlier this year of about 130 and 123. So when we continue to hear about how tight supply is, an ongoing story of this year, what in your mind actually drives price in the near term then? Because we did have that fall from more June or July through the very end of September. What data do we need to be paying attention to that impacts price more in the near term in your eyes?
Well, on a day-to-day basis, it's a whole bunch of day traders trading oil futures is the quick answer. But in the real world, it is refiners bidding against each other for raw material supply. Crude oil is the raw material of all the fuels and all the products made from petroleum. And they're just, you know, that's just how it was. If you're a furniture company, you're bidding against other people for wood. If you make wood furniture, and that's what happens. But the number one thing that I watch, and I talk to the Raymond James has a great energy sector team here in Houston. I talk to them on a regular basis, is OECD petroleum inventories. I mentioned earlier, they have a real tight, it's an inverse relationship. As inventories go down, the oil prices go up, and so do the product prices. So that's the number one thing. And right now, that relationship points directly on a historical chart of about a, you know, a 40-year chart. It points to $100 oil. Like today, the right price for oil based on that chart is $100 a barrel. Now, if that chart goes to just 25 days of consumption, the right price goes to $135. So you may have heard, some of your listeners may have heard, that Goldman Sachs has been predicting like this super spike to $135, $140 oil. Well, that's where they get that from, that chart. And it's commonly known among the oil sector analysts that OECD inventories is what you should be watching.
Well, Dan, what could disrupt the thesis? I mean, I think there's a pretty bullish case to be made for the energy sector, and there's pretty bullish information as far as the demand side, as well as the tight supply side. But you'd mentioned that there's a couple wild cards that could derail things. What would those be? And you know, what would the bearish thesis be if there was one?
Well, I mean, today, and it seems like it's flopping back and forth every week, is these COVID, zero COVID restrictions on travel in China. I mean, China is the largest consumer of oil on the world now. They import more oil than we do. And there's this worry that COVID's going to spread again and they'll shut down the whole country. But, you know, how much can you shut down that many people for long? They still got to move around, go to work, got to eat, you know, stuff like that. So that could be one, if that situation got out of the work. The other thing is kind of keeping a little bit of a lid on oil prices is the U.S. dollar, strength of the U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar is up about, 15-20% compared to a basket of other currencies, primarily the euro. So the euro has crashed. And I think even the Canadian dollar is down compared to the dollar, U.S. dollar. You know, for a currency to move that far this fast is pretty, you know, crazy. It used to be if a currency moved 1% or 2% a year, well, it's like 20% the U.S. dollar's moved. And that could reverse. If that reverses and the U.S., like, let's say Europe makes it safely through this winter and it makes a comeback and the euro comes back up, then you would see the U.S. dollar go down and oil prices go up because oil is priced in U.S. dollars around the world. Now, on the flip side of that, what could cause even a worse shortage of oil would be if the sanctions against Russia work. So far, all this talk and, you know, tough talk about Europe putting all these sanctions on Russia has only taken about 500,000 barrels of Russian oil off the market. And they produce about 10 or 11 million barrels a day, and they export about 7 million barrels a day. But these new sanctions are going to impact the tanker companies, the companies that take Russian oil and ship it around the world, because they're threatening to make it where they can't insure them, and they could put sanctions against the tanker companies and stuff like that. Personally, I think this talk about a price cap on Russian oil is totally unenforceable. I mean, I can't see them sending police into Moscow and arresting Putin or doing something to him, but, you know, we're at war with the guy. But most of the European nations know they do need to keep getting oil from Russia, and they were trying to work out some way to save political face by putting these price caps on. But if those sanctions that go into effect at the end of this year, I mean, we're only, you know, 6 weeks away from that. If that really does take Russian oil off the physical market, that's going to put upward pressure on it. The other thing would be if we have a colder winter in the EU, which forces them to burn more oil for power generation, electricity, and also just for spacing in their homes. That's going to be a big deal. We have a home, we have a heavy oil shortage for space heating oil in this country already, and you're going to hear more about that. New England is going to get hit with a cold wave this weekend. And I worked for Hess, and we sold a lot of home heating oil into the market up there. And so many people who are not paying attention, they wait until the last minute to get their tanks full, and they start calling like crazy and you don't have it. You just don't have the physical supply. And there's going to be rationing of heating oil. There's already rationing of diesel in the Southeast. I've seen pictures of, you know, entire big parking lots filled with 18 wheelers that can't get diesel. So that's a problem. But then, you know, there is some, you know, oil off the market, obviously, in Iran, Venezuela, if those political situations could be resolved. But right now, I mean, there's nothing near term on the table to solve those two countries. And then you've always got the, you know, unrest in countries like Libya, Nigeria, Angola, and they're important to the global oil supply. And, you know, from time to time, they have riots and stuff to take oil off the market.
Dan, one other aspect that we haven't touched on here, but came a bit more into the limelight at the tail end of last week when something was published on social media and then quickly brought down, deals with China, the potential backing away of this zero COVID policy. Dan, what do you think China could do to this oil market? Because it kind of seems out of mind for investors right now.
You know, if they just said, you know, and the thing that's puzzling to me is I see there's so many cases. They say, oh, we got 500 more cases of COVID. Well, the cases of COVID are like you have the flu. What we need to know is how many people are having to be hospitalized? Is it overwhelming their hospital situation? Is it causing a lot of deaths? So if there's a conspiracy here, the theory is them bringing this up on a regular basis may be their attempt to keep oil prices low by just keep bringing this thing up. So that because they're a major importer of oil, it's very important to their economy. They have to have a steady flow of crude oil imports. So maybe that. But if they would totally drop the COVID travel restrictions and everything and just get back to normal, demand for oil would probably go up several million barrels a day. I mean, it's a huge economy. You know, they burn up a lot of oil and a lot of transportation fuels.
Well, Dan, we've talked about the macro here for the energy markets for both oil and nat gas, heating oil, diesel. But let's also talk about the companies. I know as part of your service to investors, you really dig deep with some of these companies and you're looking for everything from great dividend paying stocks to stocks that have a good growth wedge to stocks that are really great producers with great cash flows. Are there any that you'd like to mention, I guess, from either the oil or the nat gas space that have got your attention lately as far as companies that are really gaining traction?
Yeah, over the last like 2 or 3 weeks, I've been getting flooded with information. It gets overwhelming this time of the quarter. But I've been updating all my valuation models for third quarter actuals. And then all these companies provide me with detailed guidance, both from the production standpoint and their expenses line by line. You know, some of them literally go over my forecast models like line by line with me. So I have a high level of confidence in those models. But on the oil side, I just published a report on a company based here in Houston area. They're in the Woodlands, Texas. The company's name is Earthstone Energy. The symbol is ESTE. I have known this management team for well over a decade. They have sold off, they've built up and sold off two previous companies, and our members, some of them have made 300%, 400%, 500% on some of those company flips. But it looks like this time they're really building this company to turn it into a mid-cap company. They went from 30,000 barrels a day in the first quarter, and now their production is over 100,000 barrels a day after a series of various, about 3 or 4 big acquisitions. And they have a lot of money behind the company. And they're already free cash flow positive. So they're going to generate $1 billion of operating cash flow this year with about $500 million of free cash flow. And the balance sheet's in good shape. They got a ton of running room. And running room is very important to me. I look for companies that have lots of low risk, high return, high quality drilling inventory, and that they have the access to capital and cash flow to, you know, execute a growth, you know, plan. And they definitely have it. Two other on the oil side I like is Ranger Oil. It was created by the merger of two companies that I have followed, both of those companies for 5 or 6 years. And I love the merger. It was recapitalized and they changed their name to Ranger Oil. It was previously Penn Virginia and they changed the name to Ranger Oil. That symbol is ROCC. And then a larger company that's kind of off the radar, it's a great company with 150,000 barrels a day of production, is PDC Energy, based in Denver, Colorado. It is the I think at the second largest producer in the DJ Basin. The DJ Basin doesn't get the attention that, you know, the Bakken or the Permian Basin gets. It's like the fifth most important oil basin in the United States. PDC is a great company. They pay a nice dividend. They're doing stock buybacks. They have tons of free cash flow. It's really got a great management team, and they've done a great job. And I think some people shy away from Colorado thinking there's, you know, political risk there. It's a blue state, but they have a great relationship and a great working relationship with the government. On the natural gas side, I have three picks I like. Antero Resources, AR, just an incredible comeback story from 2 years ago. I was afraid they were going to go bankrupt. Now they're in great shape. They are one of the top producers in the Marcellus Utica play up in Appalachia. Then Comstock Resources, on Friday, I'm going to publish a report on that one. They had a great second quarter. It's the closest thing to a pure gas company. About 99% of their production is dry natural gas coming from the Haynesville in Louisiana. You hear a lot about these companies have running out of pipeline access. They have trouble getting their product to market. Comstock has no problem. They're really close to the Henry Hub in Louisiana. They got access to a lot of big pipelines. They can get their gas directly to the Gulf Coast LNG exporters and then get it into pipes to take it up into New England too. And they have a really, really good marketing team. And then a small cap that I like just because I think it's undiscovered by the Wall Street gang is called Silver Bow Resources. Its symbol is SBOW, and Comstock is CRK. And Silver Bow is an Eagleford company. They have, they're running just two rigs, but they have got a lot of good running room. You want to hear about my Canadian companies that I like?
Real quick, Dan, before we get into your Canadian companies, one thing I'm taking away here is that, look, these companies that you've just recommended, the six of them, they're spread out around the U.S. A couple more in Texas. There are three in Texas here. They also sound a bit larger in terms of their production portfolio. Is that something you're focused on? Slightly larger companies outside of Silver Bow? Or what are some of the characteristics that set these stocks apart? Because in all fairness, even I've gotten some emails that said, when I look at these energy companies, man, they've all run so much. How do I know which one's better at this price level?
Well, I will tell you right now that Earthstone and Silver Bow are not even close to what their breakup value is right now. They are off the radar screen. You know, a year ago, they were considered very small companies, and now they're looking really good. And Silver Bow is much smaller even than Earthstone. So I do think they have a lot of running room. So, you know, people have different choices. I mean, we cover some really big companies. EOG Resources has like an $85 billion market cap. But it's also got a tremendous inventory of, you know, 10,000 drilling locations. Looks great, and it pays good dividends. So a lot of our members are really interested in dividend paying stocks, and some are really interested in growth and, you know, untold stories like this. So and that's what, you know, the Canadian companies that I look at, they're really off the radar screen in the U.S.
Well, Dan, you'd mentioned some of those Canadian companies that you'd like to bring up. I want to loop back around to that. Tell us about some of these Canadian picks you have.
Okay. And I've been following the first two. I'll tell you, InPlay Oil, that symbol is IPO. Just a great company. It's approaching being debt-free. Every company's going to have some debt. They're going to have, you know, accounts payable, whatever, but they're very soon will have their current assets exceed their total debt. They have a lot of running room. They've run up to 9,000 barrels a day and have a clear path to 15,000 barrels a day. I really, really like that company. And I like the management team. I've been following them for almost a decade. Hemisphere Energy is a smaller company. Its symbol is HME in Canada. It's on the Venture Exchange, 3,000 barrels a day production. It is now debt-free. It pays a dividend. It's got a very low decline rate in its field, in its two fields. It's got two water floods. One, they have started putting polymers in. So one's a confirmed polymer flood. The other one, they just started injecting polymers, which just thickens the water. It's no, you know, rocket science thing. I also like Surge Energy up there, SGY, and Crescent Point CPG. And they're much larger companies than the first two. So they do have more coverage. But if you're looking for the undiscovered companies, I would look at IPO and HME.
All right, Dan, always a wealth of information. It's why I like reading over your newsletter and even how you separate the companies in your different portfolios so it can fit more in terms of what individual investors are looking for, whether it's dividend payers, larger companies, some of the growth companies, all very informative for us and our listeners. Before we get you out of here, give us just a little bit more insight on this Energy Perspectives group and your newsletter. I know that there's a active forum that you also host online through that Energy Perspectives group. I'm opening up the floor to you here, Dan. Give our listeners a bit more insights into what your letter, what the Energy Perspectives group is all about.
Well, in the form it's in today, I took the Energy Perspectives group over in 2006. It was really started by another guy in 2001. And then he left. He's actually a scout for the National Hockey League now. So I got this 100%. But it was started to create a networking group of a lot of industry people at first. Most of our members were in Texas, had been in the industry for decades. And so we put that networking group. And now it's turned into just kind of a investment newsletter type thing. But we are looking for, you know, profitable oil and gas companies primarily. But we also look at some midstream. And like you said, we expanded into three model portfolios. One is the Sweet 16, kind of mid cap to large cap companies, then the small caps ones, which I think are had the most potential, but there's more risk just because of size. And then a lot of these companies have really matured to the point where they're just harvesting their assets and paying out a lot of really nice dividends. I think the last newsletter are average dividend yield in the high yield income portfolio was 9 or 10%, and several of them in double digit dividend yield. So there's just a lot of stuff in it. And I will tell you, just in the last couple months, we've seen a spike in our membership, and I've seen a lot more interest in the energy sector, primarily because it's the only sector in the S&P 500 that's actually making money this year. So I think a lot of funds are getting back to this now. I think there's been a paradigm shift that people realize we're going to be using oil and gas for many more decades, and nothing could be truer than that. But if anybody's interested in joining us, go to just energyperspectives.com. That's one word, energyperspectives.com. And somewhere on there, you can click down and see join now. The other thing you can do is send an email to energyperspectives@gmail.com. And that goes to Sabrina. She handles our member services. And just tell her that you heard about us on your show here, and she'll give you a promo code for $100 off the first year.
Boom. Dan, thank you very much for offering that to our listeners and everyone listening. I highly recommend it. If you are looking for some more independent coverage on the energy sector, I think Dan does a great job. And he shares a lot of his information with all of us on our show. So if you have the interest, please go and support Dan and the Energy Perspectives Group. Dan, thank you very much for your time on this weekend show. This wraps up our show. So everybody, thank you for tuning in this weekend. Boy, oh boy, these markets continue to be kind of a wild ride, but the energy sector is one to keep note of. And everyone, please keep your emails coming to Shad and I. We love hearing what all of you think of the show, of our guests, and of the companies we bring on. So Dan, everybody, again, have a great rest of your weekend.
All right.